Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Today we're going to be talking about one thing and one thing only, and that is the state of race relations in South Africa, as explored through the polling that the Institute of Race Relations has recently done. Now, sometimes as the Institute of Race Relations, we spend a lot of time talking about things that are not race relations, and there's a very simple reason for that. We believe that a South Africa which is free and prosperous, which protects its citizens equally and provides them with opportunities to make the lives that they want, is one in which we will have peace and harmony between different groups of people, and which is why we advocate for the particular things we advocate for. We think these are the things that will make South Africa successful. But we do also directly talk about race relations, and that's because every single year we do a poll of South Africans asking them various questions about what they think is important and, you know, what how they feel about their fellow citizens. So, Herman, anything to add about, you know, why we do this stuff? And then we can get into a little bit about how it works and then finally what it says.
Yeah, so the essence of, I think, everything we do is that we want to understand South Africa, we want to explain South Africa, and we want to improve South Africa. And all three of those, you need a proper understanding of what's going on in South Africa. And data is a critical part of that, to understand you know, what's going on in the economy. Politics is a key part of that, to understand what are the forces at play. Policy is a key part of that. History is a key part of that. But public opinion is a key part of that. All things are, you know, essentially downstream from public opinion. So if you have a good idea what the public believes, what they feel about certain things, you know, you can understand, explain, and improve. So, yeah, it's sort of one of the most remarkable and unique things about working for the IRR is this annual polling that we do that no one else really does. That just gives us, I think, added insight and the ability to explain, understand, and improve things better.
So, apologies for those listeners who have already heard this part of the discussion. We're going to talk a little bit about polling and how it works and why it's reliable. So the question that people who are unfamiliar with polling will often ask, they'll look at this and they'll say, okay, well, hold on. You surveyed 807 geographically and demographically representative registered voters between March, the end of March, and the beginning of April of this year. How can you say that that represents South Africa? What does it mean to be geographically and demographically representative? And are 807 people, I mean, you know, anyone, I guess, with enough time could ask 807 people their opinions. Why is this useful?
One of the most common responses I've had to opinion polling is, well, I've never been asked my opinion, which sort of gets to this question of, you know, how can you say you've got a representative sample? How can you say that what you actually find or what you actually see is reflective of the opinion of an entire country? So I think I've used this before, and it's an old explanation in polling, but think of a pizza. It's not a difficult thing to do for
a man of my size.
Well, it's the same. The idea of a pizza, if you want to know what a pizza tastes like, you don't need to eat the whole pizza. You don't even need to eat the majority of the pizza. You don't even need to eat a quarter or whatever. The only thing that you really need to understand what the pizza tastes like is a representative slice of the pizza, a piece of the pizza that contains all the ingredients of the whole, the cheese, the olives, the anchovies, the tomato, whatever the case may be, enough of the crust. You just need a sliver of that pizza that gives you sufficient representation of the rest of the pizza, so that by tasting that particular piece, you get a very good sense of what the rest of the pizza would taste like. And, you know, we can apply this to soup as well. You don't need to, you know, guzzle your way through a gallon of soup to understand what 5 gallons of soup might taste like. You just need to make sure that you get a representative scoop. And that's the same idea with polling. You're not trying to necessarily go for a big sample, because big samples don't automatically translate to accurate findings. For example, if I go to an ANC rally and we've got 90,000 people in attendance and I manage to ask 10,000 of them who they're going to vote for in the coming election, you might have a 10,000 strong sample, but a very, very bad finding because the sample, despite its enormous size, wasn't really representative. So you need a sample of a respectable size. But what matters more beyond that point of basic feasibility is actually whether your sample is random and representative. So generally speaking, a sample of about 600 people is considered the baseline for the representativity, in fact, irrespective of the size of the population. And you can think about it sort of in a very simple test of having one coin that you can flip and get either heads or tails. If you flip it once, then you've got 100% heads or 100% tails. You flip it 10 times, then you're probably going to get a better spread. If you're going to flip it 50 times, an even better spread close to the 50-50 matchup that we know are both sides of a coin. Then if you flip it 600 times, then you're really starting to get into the province of viability, where you end up with a roughly 50-50% split of heads and tails due just to the randomization of a coin toss and the number of coin tosses calculated. You can sort of think of that, I think it's called a Galton board, where you have sort of balls at the top and then you have these columns and these hexagonal things where the balls bounce down. And it's completely random. There's no particular repetition of it. But if you then tilt it and the balls fall downwards, what you end up usually with is a bell curve, sort of the spread of reliable data. And once you get to 600 coin tosses or 600 of these little balls, then you've got a pretty reliable bell curve. Now, our sample was 807 participants. So we clearly meet that basic minimum threshold. And just to give some context, a country as large as the United States with, you know, 350 million population, Pew Research or Gallup, the really respected and you know, legacy polling companies, they quite often poll the entire country on a sample of roughly 1,200. So if you can poll a country of 350 million with 1,200 respondents, as long as they are random and representative, then a country of, what, 60 million can reliably be polled with 807.
Right. And there are two caveats, really, to kind of how accurate these things can be. Firstly, there's a margin of error, which is that depending on all these factors that go into it, how representative you think things are, how big the sample size and stuff like that, you have sort of a margin by which you expect the poll to be slightly off by from some sort of true result. And this is actually a reason why people often, I think, kind of get confused and say, well, you know, elections are, look, all the polling is wrong about this election or that election. No one ever gets it completely right. Well, often when you have very competitive elections, particularly like in a place like the US, but, you know, anywhere really, when the results are within the margin of error, it's really difficult for polling to kind of purely drill down and get the exact results. So there's always going to be a little bit of variance. So I think one of the key things about our findings is that I don't think there are any results where the sort of margin of error really makes a difference, right? The differences between the findings are like really big. So if it's like 4 points off this way or that way.
In sort of 9 out of 10 cases, I would say there is one question where we got a margin of error, sort of essential statistical tie, but that's absolutely right. Our margin of error is 4% up or 4 percentage points up or 4 percentage points down. So if, for example, we poll something on 50%, it could actually be 54% in real life or 46%. And if you're honest about that, people should also understand that opinion polls are snapshots of a moment. They aren't predictions.
Yes, that was the second point I was going to make, is they are of a very particular moment in time. So, if you ask people, do you watch soccer around the time of the World Cup, you're probably going to get a much higher result than you would if you ask people sort of 2 years after the World Cup.
Exactly. And to so you have all these sort of dancing components that you want to sync up to make sure that you have sensible findings. Your sample size, the limits of what a poll can accomplish. It's not a prediction, it's not a crystal ball. The reality of its restrictions in terms of margins of error. Now, you can, if you are something like StatsSA, and you want to see the difference between, unemployment at 32.6% and unemployment at 32.9%, then of course it helps to have a 10,000, 20,000 survey, because then those decimal points really matter to the larger picture. But whether sort of if we look at our polling, whether 50% of people say they've experienced racism in the last 5 years, or whether that's 48 or 52, as long as we couch it responsibly, the polling findings are still, very, very useful. So you can get very, very accurate with a large sample size, but there's a point of whether investment in a poll and what you get out of it does just for the sake of what why you're polling need to match up. We're not trying to be accurate to the nth decimal point. We are just trying to get an overall accurate view on as many issues related to politics, policy, and race relations as possible.
And the last thing on this, before we move on to actually what the polls found, is basically this. Why poll? Why is this better than other things? And I think that's the key here is polling has these problems, right? It's not exactly perfect. Sometimes there can be slight errors here or there. But particularly when you look at polling over time, you get probably the most scientific possible way of looking at public opinion, what people think, and how the country is changing or not changing. And that's why these things are really invaluable to actually properly understand the country, because otherwise you get sort of pundits saying the people want X, and by the people they mean someone they talk to in an Uber, which is not a great sample.
Which and but as I always say, speaking to people in Uber could be very useful. It would be insane for
Yeah,
someone to
gives you
say.
a particular perspective.
Exactly. But it would be insane for someone to say, just look at this source of information. And that's why polling is useful, but only as useful as, a source of credible information could be. Why do we do it? Well, I think, as you said at the beginning, we at the Institute of Race Relations, we firmly believe in non-racialism. And the question is, how can non-racialism be promoted in a sustainable, constructive way that actually makes life better in South Africa? And from 100 years of IRR research and from the latest opinion polling, what the people of South Africa quite clearly indicate and what the undercurrents of the data show is that life for all people and the struggles faced by people determine their attitudes towards things. If we take the example of xenophobia, in South Africa, we get spikes of xenophobic sentiment and violence at times of intense economic pressure. That's just how human nature works. So, if we want better relations between the people of our country, we have to make sure that the economic and social pressures working out on those relations are actually as constructive or as weak as possible to make sure that the relations are healthy. I mean, it's sort of like a marriage. A marriage under financial strain is more likely than not to have emotional strain connected to it. So if we're going to be honest about the human state of affairs, about race relations, about the history of race relations manifesting in South Africa in various forms of economic inclusion and exclusion, the heart to healthy race relations actually is through a vibrant, dynamic, prosperous, and free society. And what's fascinating is that I think this polling report really puts some meat on those bones. Perhaps a last point before we get to the actual findings, I'm happy to answer questions about this on social media, or if people have them, feel free to put them in the comments. But we go to quite significant we take quite significant steps to make sure that our polling sample of 807 is representative. So number one, it has to be random. For that, software is used that generates random South African phone numbers. Now, cell phone numbers. Now, given that cell phone penetration in South Africa is between 94 and 97%, it really is the best way to reach people. It is making sure that everyone from the poorest to the richest and anyone else in between have a randomly equal shot at being contacted. You need that randomization. Otherwise, you have a biased sample. Then the second point is we match up our sample with other data that we know, like, you know, geographical distribution. In our poll, 23.5% of respondents were in Gauteng, 19% were in KwaZulu-Natal, 12.5% were in the Eastern Cape, and so on. We try to keep on building this sample until we get to geographical distribution, but not just geographical. Residential, you know, 37.1% of respondents were inhabitants of tribal lands, 30.3% were inhabitants of townships, 18% of suburbs, and so on. Then we do it by age, we do it by gender, we do it by language. IsiZulu speakers, the largest chunk of respondents, 22% in our survey, IsiXhosa 18.9%, Afrikaans 12.4%, Sesotho 12.2%, English 10.5%, and other languages 24%. And by income, by employment status, by race, by political affiliation, all of these sort of markers that we know of the population as a whole, we try to find a microcosm in our sample and build that sample until we can say, right, on all of these metrics, we are dealing with a microcosm, a smaller version of the South African population as a whole. And if anyone has any questions about the makeup of our sample, feel free to post comments. We can try to get back to you on them. But that's really why all of the above, the randomness of our slice, making sure it's got the right ingredients, being honest about the limitations, it's a snapshot, not a prediction, there's a margin of error, all of these things line up for us to have useful information on which to base our understanding of South Africa. So it's not just, you know, trying to push this or that narrative. If you listen to some of the more conspiratorial parties in Parliament, you might be led to that conclusion. But it really is trying to, at quite significant cost, because these things do cost quite a lot of money, it's making sure that they are accurate, and that's why we can have faith in the findings.
Okay, so let's get into it. What did our polling find? The thing that always strikes me is the theme that sort of runs through this, and tell me if I'm wrong as you go through this, but is that South Africans are far more united than anyone, I think, would think based on the way that our politics goes on. But what were the findings more specifically?
No, I think that's quite right. And 2025, I think, brought that issue to quite into sharp focus with our, you know, kerfuffles around Donald Trump and the idea of a refugee program for white Afrikaners, the racial controversy of the G20. It's been a year where it was easy to come to the conclusion that South Africa is a simmering pot of racial animosity. And what is remarkable about the polling is the consistency showing that that isn't the case. And it sort of reminds me of one of the things that the late, great former CEO of the Institute of Race Relations, John Ken Berman, used to say, is that the people of South Africa are one of the key countervailing forces ensuring that South Africa is still standing despite sort of 100 years of relative governmental idiocy. And that we haven't sort of blown up in a full-scale civil war, this group versus that group. It's that the people of South Africa are, generally speaking, pragmatic and moderate in their views. So the first question, of course, in South Africa is always when people from overseas consider race relations, is always, well, 1994 compared to now, how is it? And that's why one of the reasons why every year when we do our polling, we ask, since 1994, have race relations between people of different races in South Africa improved, stayed the same, or become worse? 48% say improved, 46% say improved, 36% say became worse, and 18% said stayed the same, with 1% undecided. Now, it is notable here that that 46% is lower than in previous years, but it is just 1 year compared to previous years. So it's far too early to say, we've got a trajectory of negative sentiment. But what is telling is that the difference between 36 and 46 falls with outside of the margin of error. So we can, to a rather certain degree of reasonable certainty, say that more people in South Africa believe that race relations today are better than they were in 1994. If we scratch a bit beneath the surface, we find that white South Africans now see race relations more improved than any other group. And this is a very, very useful historical point, because white South Africans, if we are going to follow the narrative of victimhood, of hatred, of racial animosity underlying everything, white South Africans are the group within South Africa who gave up the supremacy that apartheid had afforded them. If anything, if we were dealing with an intensely racialized population that can only see things through the perspective of race, we would not see 71% of white South Africans believing that race relations today are better than they were in 1994. Similarly, if Afrikaners and white South Africans were the victims of a wide and brutal systemic oppression, we wouldn't see 71% of white South Africans saying that race relations today are better than they were in 1994. So whilst the other groupings are much closer to the 40 to 50% mark, what really stands out is that we have a clear refutation here of what one could call white victimhood, or the perpetuation of, you know, the white apartheid nostalgia surviving. It's quite clear that white South Africans consider race relations in a better state today than 30 years ago, despite, as we might find out later in our conversation, white South Africans, a majority of them, reporting having an experience of racism directed at them within the last 5 years. So that's really finding number one.
So I think one of the other questions is, you know, how do South Africans really feel about each other? It's all one thing to say something very abstract about, have race relations gotten better or worse? Because, of course, everyone's going to have sort of different definitions of what that really means. Mm-hmm. But the next question was a much more specific one, right? Which is, do we actually, do South Africans of different races need each other?
And in designing a questionnaire, you want to be as neutral, as objective as possible. You can't, for example, say, given the ANC's horrendous track record on corruption, who would you vote for in an election? Or you can't say, given the great magnanimity.
You ask people five questions about particular corruption scandals and then afterwards ask them who they're going to vote for. Like, say,
exactly.
How do you feel about ANC politician who stole this money, this money, this money, this money, and then say, now who do you think you're going to vote for?
Exactly. So you have to design your survey with some integrity. And that is why we give voters, number one, we try to group the questions in fair ways. And number two, we try to word them in as neutral terms as possible. And this is the wording of the question that you are asking about. Indicate whether you agree or disagree with the following statement. The different races need each other for progress, and there should be full opportunity for people of all colors. Now, I particularly like this question because consistently it gives us an astonishing majority. In our latest data, it's an 84% majority saying, yes, we agree. The races need each other for progress, and there should be full opportunity for people of all colors. Now, there's a 16% disagree quotient, but I think that's completely healthy in a society, especially given our history, to have such a supermajority being in favor of sort of an aspiration, a desire for healthy, non-race-based prosperity, progress for all, is, I think, such a powerful indicator that despite what we see and hear, and despite even the personal experience of racism, people want to see South Africa fundamentally as a non-racial and successful country where people get along. They might not call it non-racial. That might be too ideological a term, but they want to get along. And they see that this isn't a situation where you could have one favorite group and an outside group. And what's particularly impressive, if we look at these questions, is that there's a heavy weightage towards younger South Africans being more positive about race relations, both in terms of the question of 1994 to today, but also in this question of do we actually need each other? So again, we've got a positive response, whether we look at it by whatever metric, perhaps race is the most significant one, with the statement that the races need each other for progress and that there should be full opportunity for all people. 84% overall agree, 80% of Black people agree, 87% of colored people agree, 100% of Indian people agree, and 93% of white people agree. So clearly, you might have a give or take in terms of some of these numbers shifting within the margin of error, but they are nowhere close to the disagree quotient that is, 10, 20, 0, 0, and 3. So once again, looking at the question of race relations and connecting it to this idea of socioeconomic prosperity, economic growth, the consensus is rather remarkable.
Right. It's that people on a sort of fundamental aspirational level still buy into the idea of the Rainbow Nation.
Yes.
That they still believe that this is a country for all who live in it, I think is the ANC loves to quote from the Freedom Charter.
Yes.
Okay. So next question, is about sort of omnipresence of racism, right?
Yeah.
I think... There's often a lot of discussion about racist incidents in the media. I mean, look, to be honest, in recent years, I think there have been fewer of these in terms of ones that have kind of blown up in the media in a big way. But still, by and large, there's often discussion about racial aspects or racism playing a part in, like two people will fight in a spur and then people will, sort of analyze it in a racial lens.
Yeah.
Or there'll be a racist incident where someone is clearly racist to someone else. What were the findings on that stuff?
So this is the personal experience of racism. And the question is, have you personally experienced any form of racism in the past 5 years? Now, this is where we get the roughly 50-50 split, the within the margin of error I said at the start. 52% say no, and 48% say yes. So for the sake of argument, for the sake of understanding this data set in a responsible way, we could treat those two groups as, equally weighted. So that isn't a wonderful statistic, but we shouldn't just take the statistic for itself, assuming that because one in two people experience racism, we're a racist country. Because remember, this is a country where 84% of people have this expression of a desire for a non-racial, equal opportunity society. And what becomes very interesting on this specific question is if we align race, employment status, and income, something very interesting pops out of the data. The two groups most likely to answer in the affirmative that they have experienced racism in the last 5 years from a racial perspective are white South Africans and Indians. So here it is interesting that the whole critical race theory, blacks will always be victims narrative, really just clunks out of the bus, because on this data, black South Africans are in fact the least likely to respond with yes, I have experienced personal racism, with whites and Indians being more likely to respond that they have responded, that they have experienced racism. That sort of takes the victimhood hierarchy of sort of white straight males at the top and everyone else sort of trickling down, and turns it upside down, because it's if white can be more victims of racism, at least in their personal reporting, than black people, then something of that explanatory theory of whites at the top, blacks at the bottom doesn't quite work. But if we look at status in the economy, the two categories where experience of racism has been more potent than its inverse is the formal versus the informal economy. The formal economy, if you're a business owner, there's a 58% responding yes on the question of personal racism. If you're employed in the formal economy, that is roughly the same, 57%. But then if we look at the informal economy, only 30% of informal economy business owners and 35% of informal economy participants in terms of the labor force of the informal economy say that they've experienced racism. Now, there are components of explanatory consideration that come into play. But what makes it interesting is if we add the final component of the report, and that is the income level. The two categories with the highest reported incidence rate of personal experiences of racism in the last 5 years are 8,000 Rand to 20,000 Rand in monthly income and 20,000 and above. That is usually your formal economy, upper working class or aspirant were middle class or middle class and above. Now, if we align these three findings, whites and Indians, formal economy, economic participation, and middle class income levels, what we see here is the groups that are most directly affected by policies like BEE and employment equity in a negative sense are the groups reporting higher incidence of personal experiences of racism in the last 5 years. So if we think about the aspiration of wanting a non-racial society, of white South Africans to the tune of 71% saying race relations today are better than they were in 1994, we're not seeing racially victimized, organic sort of horizontal relationships between people. What we are seeing where racism is experienced, it happens in those parts of society where racialized policies have their most significant consequences. So this is another key finding from the report, is that policies like BEE, like employment equity, actually worsen race relations, worsen the experience of racism, despite having this ostentatious, you know, self-congratulatory theme connecting them that, this is for redress. And it's fascinating that policy is making things worse, where we see not policy, but personal preference determine race relations, we see positivity. Where we see policy affecting race relations, we see negativity.
So one of the other questions that's sort of connected to this one is about, you know, sort of how politics interacts with these discussions about racism and colonialism. Do you just want to take us through that one very quickly?
Yeah, so what the report says is it takes this dual reality of racism being experienced, but not necessarily approved of as a political tool. And in this sense, we ask the question, indicate whether you agree or disagree with the following statement. All this talk of racism and colonialism is by politicians who are trying to find excuses for their own failures. So this is essentially boiling down to the question of whether South Africans agree that race-based rhetoric and grievance-based rhetoric based on racial disparities from the past, whether that is justified? And the answer is a resounding no. 76% of South Africans say they agree with this statement, that this talk of racism and colonialism is sort of a smokescreen for political failure. And it's not even one group necessarily dominating. You've got 73% of Black South Africans taking that position, 72% of white of coloured South Africans, 100% of Indian South Africans, though caveats apply, this group is notoriously difficult to poll because of their relative size in the South African population, and then 91% of white South Africans agreeing. So not even close to the margin of error. You've got these consistent majorities saying that, yes, one in two of us experienced racism in the last 5 years. Yes, there are policy implications that connect to the experience of racism. But we have a normative aspiration of a non-racial country, and we actually reject the weaponization of race by politicians. We see political rhetoric about race and colonialism and racial grievance as politicians trying to dodge accountability. That is a very healthy state of affairs in terms of a country like South Africa, where racism is a factor in society, but South Africans just disapprove of it being used as a political cudgel. Encouragingly, that means we are quite likely moving into a province of politics or into a period of politics where, unlike the 1990s, race mobilization for political ends will have continuing diminishing returns.
So it's clear from the data that South Africans are sort of aspirationally pretty much on the same page, and that they by and large have pretty similar views about race and politics. But when it comes to sort of issues, right, the things that are affecting us today and also how to fix them, the data is interesting because it seems to suggest once again that people are kind of by and large on the same page as each other.
Yes, and for this section of the report, it's really important to understand the national desire for jobs, for employment, because every single year of our polling, the finding of the top priority with varying methodologies, varying questions, has been South Africans want jobs. That's really the number one priority they want government to focus on. By and large, this applies to all race groups. For every single racial group, unemployment is the priority number one, by varying degrees, but job creation right up there, even for the political parties, the four big ones, EFF, MK, ANC, DA. There's agreement on across racial lines, across party lines, that we agree with this. So then if we take this data seriously, showing job creation as the top priority and incidentally inequality and racism as the bottom two priorities out of a list of roughly, I think, 18 possible priorities, then we add to that our findings on this question. Indicate whether you agree or disagree with the following statement: with better education and more jobs, the present inequality between the races will steadily disappear, where we get a 73% majority in favor. Once again, clear majorities across all racial groups. If you combine that desire for jobs, for the key that racial inequality is solved through skills development, education, and skills application in an economically constructive way, jobs, then we get to who should be appointed to jobs. Then we get directly to employment equity, BEE type questions. Now, BEE essentially rests currently on two pillars: on making sure that corporate representativity is racialized, rewarding so-called, black employment, black shareholdership, black management structures. And employment equity is quite deliberately based on this idea that representativity of the races is what the people of South Africa want. But we challenge, or we investigate this, and the findings challenge that assumption quite directly. We ask, who should be appointed to jobs in South Africa? And we give four options. Only black people should be appointed to jobs for a very long time ahead, 9% support. Only black people should be appointed until those in employment are demographically representative of the population. The almost word for word philosophical basis of employment equity, 6% support. Then we ask the question, appointment should be made on the basis of merit, but there should be special training, not treatment, not special sort of BEE, special needs opportunities in the workforce, training. So merit plus training for previously disadvantaged people, 54%. Then just straight merit, all appointments should be made on the basis of merit alone without any special training being available, 31%. So if we cluster the two questions that are sort of essentially race-based together, and we cluster the two question of merit with their various qualifications, then you get an 85% majority in favor of merit in some form, which is particularly encouraging given that there's broad agreement that skills development and jobs, the exact things endorsed on the basis of who people should be, who people believe should be hired, those are also the ingredients identified for getting rid of racial inequality. So when we understand that jobs really are the main priority, not just in terms of in and of itself being a useful socioeconomic achievement, but also being key to eradicating racial inequality, and we investigate how those jobs should be awarded, we find a pragmatic, moderate, non-racial answer and clear majorities on all those questions, indicating just the pragmatism and the moderate stance that could make this country really successful.
So firstly, where can people read the polling report if they want to read it?
It's on the IRR website. You can, you know, just Google IRR polling 2025, and you will get the three polling reports that I authored this year. First one on politics, second one on policy preferences, and third one on race relations. And I tried to do them justice. I follow in the footsteps of sort of giants when it comes to the IRR's polling. But feel free to Google or send us an email, and we'll make sure you can get the slides and the reports.
And any final thoughts before we close up for today?
I think my key takeaway from the data is that we are looking at a deracialized electorate still operating in a political racialized sort of landscape, where the political class still insist on racialism, still insist on divvying up the population along specific historic apartheid era lines, where we have an electorate increasingly and sustainably hateful for that nonsense. So I think that is truly encouraging. And my advice to people would be, don't let this finding just hang in the air. We are a year or a year and a half away, whatever, from the next round of elections. Political parties are going to come beg for your vote, ask for your vote, campaign for your vote over the next year and a bit. Use that to say, well, what are you doing on jobs? Because the data shows we want jobs. I don't see jobs in your plan. If they can't answer that, pressure them. Move on to another party. I can promise you they would want your vote. Number two is, don't let the non-racialism finding just be theoretical. Go to the political parties, or when they come to you, engage with them and say, look, folks, I've spoken to some people, I've read the IRR's research. The country wants non-racial, pragmatic, moderate policies. Where are they? Show me the goods. Because if we as a country are going to reach a place where the only time we engage with policies coming from political parties are when they tell us their manifestos, we are abrogating our responsibility. We have the opportunity, and I think the responsibility, to shape what is upstream from politics. No one in a manifesto has to say, I think we should make, you know, trousers really part of everyday garments, because it's upstream from politics. If we can get to that sort of consensus upstream from politics, politics becomes the rule-taking rather than the rule-making part of democracy. And I think we've got an opportunity and we've got the momentum on our side to do that.
All right. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you found this show interesting. I think we'll add some chapter skips in the discussion. So if you're showing this video to anyone else, just make that clear to them so they can skip the methodology bit if they've already heard that stuff. But thank you very much, Herman. Important stuff you're doing as always. And I hope that we shall all see you tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.